Good afternoon. Today is Friday, the 10th of May, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, and I'm delighted to be joined by Debbie Evans today and Ben Rubin. I'll also add, it's just wonderful here in Plymouth. I think there's a touch of summer coming into the air, so we're going to enjoy that, well, a little bit later anyway. Debbie, I'm going to be welcoming you. I'm just going to say to our audience, I'm very sorry you're not here in the studio, but of course, we've got millions and millions of pounds for weapons in Ukraine, but apparently we can't run the trains from Cornwall. But you can tell me more about that in a minute. I thought we'd start off today with just an appalling piece of reporting from the BBC. It's very simple. Let's have a look at it. This was the headline: Kiev can use British weapons inside Russia. Cameron can use. But the moment you got into the article, it said this: Lord Cameron did not directly endorse the idea of British weapons being used to strike targets inside Russia. As far as I'm concerned, this is deliberate manipulation of text. This is disinformation by the BBC. And the minimum is it's designed to confuse events in the public mind. So if any of our audience today feel as I do, it warrants, I think, a complaint to the BBC, because a multi-billion pound organisation, a state media outfit, should not be allowed to get away with such crass reporting. I'll leave that there. Debbie, welcome. You've come in on a link. It's a real shame that you couldn't make it on the train to be in the studio.
I'm really sorry. I was looking forward, actually, to a sunny trip on the train, but I was told that because of the train strikes and the overtime bans, no trains were guaranteed, and that many platforms, even though it said the train was coming, it never showed up. So apologies. But sometime soon, I'll be with you in the studio, I promise. But isn't hindsight a wonderful thing? Because with the recent news, obviously, of AstraZeneca being withdrawn, we were all looked upon 4 years ago as conspiracy theorists. And sadly, we have been proven right. We weren't conspiracy theorists at all. And I wonder sometimes when we look back, if some of the people responsible, their words will come back to haunt them, because we're not going to forget, are we? We're never going to forget. And that's why I want to highlight two, but actually three women in particular. Now, the BBC reported that in the birthday honours in 2021, the COVID vaccine heroes were recognised by the Queen. You can see there that you've got Kate Bingham in red, Dame Kate Bingham, and you've got Dame Sarah Gilbert in blue. I probably should have put Dame June Rain in there as well, because I just want to highlight that Dame Sarah Gilbert made AstraZeneca. Dame June Rain approved AstraZeneca, and Dame Kate Bingham was responsible for choosing it, procuring it, and distributing it. So in my opinion, those three women were responsible for every single AstraZeneca injury and death in the United Kingdom. And certainly Kate Bingham and June Rain were responsible for the rollout of every single vaccine in the UK. So I want to start off with Dame Kate Bingham today, but I just want to let you know that Dame Kate Bingham, she has a master's in biochemistry from Oxford. She's also got a master's in business studies from Harvard. And because of that, she got an honorary doctorate from Imperial. So this is an honorary doctorate, and she's been working closely with pharmaceutical companies. Now, back in 2022, she gave a lecture along with Dame June Rain, actually, at Somerville. It was called the Somerville Spring Meeting, 5th of March, 2022, entitled From Wartime to Peacetime. She was followed on immediately after by Dame June Rain. So I want to show you a little bit of video. I'm beginning to wonder whether Dame Kate Bingham thought that she was in her front room talking to her friends, or whether she'd ever realised that we would come to see what she said 2 years ago. Let's have a listen. Kate Bingham.
I ended up with an email on April Fool's Day inviting me to join this expert group, and to which my reaction was, well, I'm not a vaccine expert, Patrick. Why on earth are you asking me? And the answer was, what he wanted was somebody with that expertise and knowledge of the small company landscape, because that's actually where the innovation comes from, even if it's ultimately the pharmaceutical companies that deliver and distribute.
So April Fool's Day, she got an email from Patrick Vallance. She wasn't really qualified in anything to do with vaccines. So if we go and look at uk.gov and see the announcement of her appointment, you might note there it says that her job was to enable a task force to accelerate the development. That's a very important word. The development of a safe and effective vaccine. She goes on to say, if you just skip to the next slide there, that she's worked in the biotech sector for a very long time. Could you just go back a slide? That's it. So she's uniquely qualified for the role and worked in the biotech center, in the biotech sector. But she's most recently managing partner for SV Health Investor. So her work has led to the launch of 6 drugs for the treatments of patients with inflammatory and autoimmune disease. So if you just skip to the next slide, we can see that Sir Patrick Vallance said that it's vital that the UK continues to play its leading role in trialling potential vaccines and stands ready to get behind any viable vaccine candidate. This word trialing is extremely important. So let's look at a little bit more about Kate Bingham. So we can see that she is managing partner of SV Health Investment. That's a leading international life sciences venture capital firm. So she's a venture capitalist. We can also see that she's heading up the UK's Dementia Discovery Fund. We'll come on to that a little bit more. But that was set up by all the pharmaceutical companies, so no conflicts of interest there then, and the Department of Health. If you skip on just one more slide again, you can see there we have got her company, Health Investors, investing in tomorrow's healthcare breakthroughs. So let's see what they actually deal with. What do they deal with? Well, they deal with therapeutics, dementia, healthcare, growth, and med tech. So this is the company that she's involved in. If we go to see her on the board, we can make sure, just verify everybody, please go back and check all of this out yourself. On the Dementia Discovery Fund, there she is, Dame Kate Bingham. But who funds the Dementia Discovery Fund, I wonder? So I've just drawn a few arrows to show you a few, just a few of them. And you can see that we've got the Gates Foundation, Bill Gates, we've got AstraZeneca, we've got Pfizer, we've got the Department of Health, we've got GlaxoSmithKline. I mean, you know, the conflicts of interest are enormous. But that's not all, because she's also a board member of the Francis Crick Institute. So there you go. She's an honorary board member of the Francis Crick Institute. But I want you to have another little look at her performance at the lecture at Somerville, because we're coming up to another video. And, how would you chair a government meeting, do you think? It's a serious business chairing a government meeting. And who do you think navigated or helped navigate her way through government to get her conditions met? Have a listen.
And so during the third meeting I attended, I got a text from Matt Hancock. And I was actually trying to do 2 meetings at the same time because I had a clash with one of my portfolio companies. So I had two screens up, which is, of course, not how you're supposed to do meetings. But anyway, I did. And he texted me and said, can we speak? And I said, no, you're supposed to be joining this meeting anyway. And it's a government, you know, vaccine meeting. So anyway, we spoke afterwards. And he said, would you chair the vaccine task force? You know, we're going to create a dedicated body. To which I sort of virtually fell off the chair because I hadn't thought on earth why was he calling me. I asked for 24 hours to think about it because I gave him all the reasons why I couldn't do it. And then eventually he said to me, Kate, look, none of us have done this before. We're asking you to step up. And that was a little hard not to take that seriously. And when I questioned him on what authority was he inviting me, he said he'd just come back from the Prime Minister. So I asked for 24 hours. I am very lucky to be married to the most amazing husband, Jesse Norman, who then was Financial Secretary of the Treasury. So obviously he actually spent £1 billion doing furlough and all the self-employed funding. But he absolutely helped sort of help me navigate through government and Whitehall and Parliament and everything. And so in the following day, we went back with Jesse's clear advice with a list of conditions saying I would do it, but only subject to these terms. So the terms were, it was reporting to the Prime Minister. It was a 6-month term. I could recruit who I wanted, and the government would put in place a very streamlined decision-making process. And then, because I was convinced that government always leaks everything, my final condition was that I got to sign off on all comms. But it didn't really make any difference, that one. But all the other ones did make a difference.
Woman that gets her own way, eh? Set down the conditions, navigated by her husband, who was in charge of £1 billion furlough. Very nice, don't you think? Not. So let's look at her husband, Jesse Norman, because he was indeed a minister, an MP and minister, but he resigned from the government last November to focus on local issues. But according to Wiki, he is also a member of the Privy Council. So he has got high roles, and of course, there you've got the confirmation that he is married to Kate Bingham. So let's find out a little bit more about Kate Bingham, because a little article from Welt gave a little bit more of an insight into who she was. The article was actually entitled Former UK Vaccines Chief Says Yes to Russian Jab If Data Is Good. Well, to be honest with you, she'd say yes to any jab if she could get it in the arms of the British. But if you look at the, there's an interesting article actually, but there's loads of questions. This is the first one. Are the Brits more happy to take a risk? Well, actually, yes, because they're willing to pay upfront when they've got absolutely no clue whether anything's going to be safe or whether it's going to be whether it's going to work. When asked about the speed of authorisation, she was very quick to praise the MHRA. And let's not forget, she was followed on in the lecture by June Rain. One of the other questions she was asked about was indemnity. And she revealed then that actually it wasn't a choice and that the vaccine companies had the government by the throat. And they basically said, if you don't give us indemnity, we won't give you the vaccine. So the government are reported to have felt very uncomfortable. So we'll end on one short video. But what I can say is we're going to be showing, if you think the videos that we've shown just now are shocking, we have far more to show you in extra, particularly hairy, scary. That's a clue. But let's just finish on this one video from Kate Bingham in her performance at Somerville.
I knew that if any one of these vaccines worked, we will have picked the best ones in that, because we had a real kick-ass team that did the work properly. But I didn't know if anyone would work. I mean, the biggest, much bigger concern was, might they all fail? And one of the things I'd persuaded the government to do, which they, again, were really ballsy to do, was they were willing to put money up front before we knew whether or not any of these vaccines would work. Because if we waited to figure out whether or not the vaccines were both safe and effective before we started scaling up and manufacturing, it would be another year before we got the vaccines. So we had to start investing in manufacturing scale up as soon as we decided we were going to prioritise those vaccines and support the clinical development. But if those vaccines failed, all that money would be wasted. So we ended up spending 900 million sterling in upfront spending, all of which could have been lost in order to buy what was, 357 million doses.
So if they'd have waited for health and for safety and efficacy data, they would have waited another year. So they didn't bother. I rest my case.
Debbie, thank you very much. So much I could say about that. But of course, what she said to camera was that she wasn't qualified and that the team was put together in a rush. And then later she describes it as a quote, kick-ass team, which did a good job, but it wasn't qualified to do a good job. She wasn't qualified to do a good job. And now we've got people who are damaged as a result of these vaccines. It's truly astonishing. Ben, I better bring you in on screen because I could talk about that one for quite a lot longer. You are on the subject of Ernst & Young and consultants all working in the background. So should we trust these people?
Well, it's all the same people. That's the thing, right? Because we're talking about a different organisation, different part of the British state. But ultimately, this is corporate state capture is what we're looking at. They've turned the government into a marketplace. It really begs the question, what is the state for? What is it doing? Who is it there to serve and who is it there to benefit? Because it's not the British people. It cannot be, based on what we've just seen and what I'm going to talk about now. So let me introduce you to Josie Kluwer. She is a partner at EY, formerly known as Ernst & Young, the global consulting firm. And she is at the epicenter of the public-private marketplace that has been built up on top of the UK government and the UK civil service. She's been at EY for 8 years. She has two roles. She leads the people consulting business across government and infrastructure, which has trebled under her leadership. We could bring the slide on screen. We can just see this quote there. So she leads the people consulting business, which is all about the transformation of people. And secondly, she leads our work, EY's work, around the reskilling revolution, helping organizations build the skills they need both now and in the future, including via our managed learning service. And our flagship client is the UK government, where she leads work providing bespoke learning and coaching across 500,000 civil servants. EY are actively engaged right now in retraining, reskilling, transforming 500,000 civil servants, the permanent workers of the British government. This is a huge business for EY. They've been in it for years. In fact, we know that they're currently turning over in the region of £200 million a year in fees from the British state. If we could bring this next slide up on screen, please. This was Craig Watkins, who's now currently the chief executive of Varian, which is the global propaganda and behavior change consultancy. I've spoken about them quite a bit recently. We just click on one. We can see that before he was CEO there, he spent 3.5 years as the UK business development lead for government and public sector at EY. EY GPS market was 165 million a year. At that point, that was pre-2019, and obviously since COVID, those numbers have gone up significantly, and I know that EY have been targeting government as a growth sector, so we're probably looking at a couple of £100 million going to this organisation to retrain the civil service, amongst other things. Now, let's go back to Ms. Kluwer. She passed some commentary, as you would expect, on what's going on in the civil service, specifically the people plan. Some fairly uncontroversial statements, but the one thing she highlighted at the end was that she expected the report to say more about how the civil service plans to use AI to deliver government services and therefore how people need to be trained to make the most of AI. Similarly, it said nothing about the need for civil servants to regulate AI and how they'd be prepared to do so. I don't think the civil service should be regulating anything, but apparently she does. And there was no mention of how AI and Gen AI can be used in all elements of the people function to make processes quicker, better, cheaper. So a lot of this is about cost reduction and also fairer. So it needs to be just and is essentially part of reordering society and moving us towards a world where we are ultimately governed by algorithms. And EY all over this, as we can see from this recent piece of communication from them about building their own AI capabilities.
This is the face of EY.ai, a unifying platform connecting EY's diverse people, ecosystems, and leading technology capabilities.
The face of confidence, seeing opportunity and risk from every part of your enterprise and sector.
The face of multiple disciplines, of helping to create
exponential value whilst ensuring positive human impact.
The face of collaboration, of a best-in-class ecosystem brought together on EY Fabric.
the face of the future, of people augmented and empowered by AI.
This is the face of EY.AI,
helping to build a better working world.
Find out how you can have confidence
in the opportunities AI brings.
So you can see we're not even dealing with people anymore. You're dealing with humans controlled by an algorithm. Essentially, the institution, the technology, the entity is what you're interacting with. It's not even a person. And this is what's being embedded into the heart of the UK civil service. Really reminds me of this from Little Britain. Computer says no. That's where we're heading to with the state. If the algorithm hasn't allowed for it, then you just don't exist. We won't have to deal with you. And it's not just the civil service. It's the rest of government as well. The ministers have been piling in. So this is Gillian Keegan, current Secretary of State for Education. She was down at EY last week gushing about the AI revolution and how it's going to completely reshape the way that we educate our children. She was talking about personalised AI assistance for teachers to create lesson plans and quizzes, which is what I thought the teachers did. But anyway, they're also running a hackathon with another big consulting firm and the National Institute for Learning to think about how they can deploy this across the education system. And she's adamant that we will only become a global leader in AI, as this is obviously a desirable thing, through strong collaboration between government, education and business, right? So this is a public-private marketplace. Completely by coincidence, this is aligned perfectly to the World Economic Forum communication grid. So this came out at exactly the same time last week from Saadia Zahidi, who's the MD at World Economic Forum, talking about new technology transforming our classrooms. And how can we support education systems to manage both new opportunities and the risks? Note the language repeated from the AI video and this statement. They're talking exactly the same language, which is really unsurprising given that EY is a World Economic Forum strategic partner. So they are one of the top organizations internationally, one of the top 100 organizations working with the World Economic Forum to define and execute strategy. They sit right at the heart of public-private integration. So Julie Tigland, who's the European head of Ernst & Young, was talking about convening the UK public and private sector through 2023 across all industry sectors, all political parties. You can see a bunch of big names listed there. So they're heavily involved in the transformation of the state. But what else are they doing? So let's look at the provenance of these people, where they're coming from ideologically, and how this is frankly transforming the way that our society runs. Well, we know that Carmine De Sibio, who's the current CEO of EY, is a member of the steering group of the Council on Inclusive Capitalism, which is Linda Rothschild's philanthropic endeavor. Miss Rothschild here, you can see in front of you, this is her gesture towards empathy and kindness and unity and justice being disseminated. EY are also very heavily represented at Gold's House at Davos and elsewhere. Here is Carmine and the incoming CEO, Janet Trencali, with Samantha Power from USAID, who's married to Cass Sunstein, the author of Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas, Democracy and the Problems of Free Speech. Again, all of this being mainlined right into the UK government. And they're not just working with Gold's House. Steve Varley, who's the former EY managing partner for the UK, is actually on the Gold's House board, right? So essentially, these organisations have fused with each other in some way. And his successor in the EY UK sustainability role is this guy, Rob Papel, who we spoke about last week. He was talking about the critical role that CFOs have to play in sustainability and controlling the way that organisations operate, which makes EY crucial to Terra Carta. And actually, they've received the Terra Carta seal. So this is the King Charles' sustainability initiative. They're also heavily linked into common purpose. And in fact, the person who was probably Josie Kluwer's boss is a common purpose graduate. Brian and I have spoken about that previously. You should go check out that interview to get a bit more background to them. And let's also not forget that they're making an absolute bucket load of cash out of this as well. So don't feel too sorry for these people. EY, they did have to cut their partner payouts by 40,000 this year because fees had dropped, probably because the COVID fees had dried up. But they were still paying each other £761,000 a year from doing this work, not least for UK government.
Ben, thank you very much. Very interesting segment. So retraining and also reframing 500,000 civil servants and at the same time Ernst & Young embedded in the political system itself. This is a very, very dangerous precedent. What is the elected government? What is global big business? It's getting increasingly difficult to tell. But reframing is what I suspect the biggest agenda of those civil servants is. Well, let's move on. If Ernst & Young has had to tragically cut bonuses by £40,000 for a mere £5 a month, you can receive all of UK column news and our interviews and the seminars as well, plus much else besides. So £5 a month, not a lot these days. Share the information. This is why we do it. Please give us some credit for the work that we produce, but otherwise share as far and wide as possible. And also you can make a purchase in our shop to help us out. Water bottles are particularly popular and summer is approaching, so you might think of one of those. Plus, I have another use, which I'll speak to you about at the end of the news. Debbie, your blog will be up very shortly. Do you want to give us just a quick summary of what you've been talking about?
Indeed, I will, Brian. Well, I was asked for my opinion on the National Autistic Society. So you've got it, warts and all, everybody. What's FLIRT? Well, we might be able to talk briefly about FLIRT in extra. And quantum teleportation, is it real? Yes, it probably is. And I'm very concerned about the disability benefits overhaul. So I've gone into quite a bit of depth about that. And yes, we really do have an internet of animals.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Now, I'd just like to give people a reminder that I was really pleased to be able to do these interviews. The first one with J. Michael Waller discussing his book Big Intel about the CIA and the FBI. And what he's really talking about is subversion of the American intelligence agency. So if you haven't watched that interview, please get onto UK Column and have a look. And the second one is with Michael Nels, MD, PhD. The Indoctrinated Brain is the title. Another book, really fascinating piece of work. And of course, I learned so much from this man about what is being done to interfere with normal thought processes. Now, Mike Robinson should be on the road at the moment, heading to somewhere along the south coast near Worthing. And that's for the Steyning Centre, where the Western Empire and the Great Reset lecture will be taking place at 10:30 on Saturday morning. And that's £5 through PayPal or on the door if you can get there to support them and Mike Robinson. Now, I'm going to move on to the subject of... we've also got Alternative View 14. Many apologies, Alternative View team. Just to remind people, that's taking place on Sunday, the 26th of May. And if you book your ticket and mention UKC10, that will give a discount and will also help them with their marketing. So please do that. Okay, I'd like to move on to the subject of low emission zones. And there have been a few people contacted me to say, well, the UK column hasn't been covering what's happening on the ground. Absolutely true. We have missed some of the events that have taken place where people have been challenging the ULEZ system with Sadiq Khan. But we're going to try and make up for that today. And also to take off the lid, to take the lid off the scale of the sheer thing. So this was a report, of course, praising Sadiq Khan for his third term as London mayor. But in the background, the ULEZ protests have been going on and in some ways are getting worse. I have been sent some pictures. This was for a while ago in April, but police on the streets in Thrale Road, Tooting and London area, suburbs of London. And of course, the police particularly tough on anybody challenging the system. Let's have a little look at this clip here, which is actually Sadiq Khan himself simply dismissing anybody who's protesting as being some right-wing extremist. Let's have a look at this clip.
What I find unacceptable, though, is some of those who've got legitimate objections joining hands with some of those outside who are part of a far-right group who are... Let's call a spade a spade. Some of those outside are part of the far right. Some are COVID deniers. Some are vaccine deniers. And some are Tories. Experts around the world have never seen a policy so transformative. If it's good enough for those in central London, why isn't it good enough for those in outer London? They're right. Look, you know, clean air is a human right, not a privilege.
So anybody who dares challenge the system is going to be put down by Mr. Khan, but disingenuous, absolutely, and we'll be having a look at him in a little bit more detail in a couple of minutes. But just a little bit more on the protests themselves. A ULEZ bus has been in operation, and this is very interesting to see. I'd like to learn more about this. I think we have a gentleman coming on screen with a banner in a minute. Yeah, no ULEZ, no pay per mile. So it's very clear that people are upset with what's happening. And maybe the scale of the protests has increased. Let's have a look at this little video report.
Oh, here we are, border of the ULEZ zone. Everyone, I'm sure you can see all the filthy air around here that we need this ULEZ for. But, oh, there is no filthy air because we're out in the middle of the countryside with trees and lakes and And yeah, the ULEZ has fallen over again, folks. Look at that, straight through the wire. The lights are out here, they've already been out. Put a little sign on it, little cone. But yeah, here at the river, folks, here at the river. ULEZ is dead, all painted up. It's looking a bit, I think the painters have gone a bit mental. I don't know if they're missing the ULEZ. Oh no, they've got the ULEZ too, all painted up and squirted up, but someone's come and chopped it down. This isn't good enough. We don't want them painted. We want them off our streets.
Well, sad end to that camera. Now, Sadiq Khan would have us believe that he's implementing this policy for the benefit of London and people in the outer London suburbs, but there's a lot more to it. And I want to say here that if people search for information on the UK Column website, you will find a huge amount about global cities, which is where the real policy is coming from. 13 pages on a simple search of global cities. And if we go for a UK Column search on Sadiq Khan himself, we're going to come up with a couple of full pages of information. And of course, where there's a reference to the UK Column News, there's a lot of detail in the show notes themselves. So I'm just going to say very gently for some of our viewers and listeners that if you're saying we're not reporting on certain issues, very often we are. And we have been for some time. But of course, you have to look for the information on the UK Column website. And I think most people will be very surprised at the sheer amount of information if you carry out the search. Now, let's get back onto the subject, which is Sadiq Khan. And of course, a key company or a key organization we have to look at in relation to him is C40 Cities. And if you have a look at the on-screen text here, it's talking about his work in support of this, particularly for cities in the global south. Nothing to do with people in UK or London or the outer suburbs. It's the global south. He's working with the budget. He's working with air quality. He's working with inclusive climate change action. But when you look at the C40 Cities site, it starts to get interesting with who else is involved. So we've got a hedge fund, Children's Investment Fund Foundation. We've also got Bloomberg Philanthropies. We'll have a little look at those. But look at the sheer number of people involved with Sadiq Khan in C40, in the C40 Cities program. Major funders, the UK government, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Denmark, IKEA, Hewlett Foundation, Global Environment, L'Oreal, Open Society, George Soros, Amazon Pledge, Zurich, insurance, the Scottish government, on it goes, including Google. So when people are looking at Sadiq Khan and saying he's the man causing the problem, no, not really. He's simply the puppet who's following the agenda from these much bigger, tougher organisations. Arup is in there, which might catch Ben's attention, the London School of Hygiene and the World Bank. So this is very powerful. Now, if we look at the first link through, this was the one, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation. And you can go, you should go to the website and have a look. Slightly spooky because you quickly find that the people identify themselves as children. What do I mean? Let's have a look at the slide. Kate Hampton is the chief executive. Let's make her grow up so we can see who we're dealing with. I found this rather distasteful that they've used their images of children. But this is the way it is. And if we look at this lady herself, well, she's very interesting because she's done so many roles. She's worked as CEO of the Children's Investment Fund. She's been involved with climate change. She's worked for the China Council on International Cooperation in Environment and Development. And if we move our arrow, we can also see here that she was named as a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. So Sadiq Khan is a very small player in a very big pond, which is driving him. And just to give you some idea of the number of people involved in this investment foundation itself, let's scroll through the children to see how many we're really dealing with. Now, remember, these aren't children, they're executives working in this organization. But my point is, this is not a few people. This is a very large, powerful organization, which is absolutely demonstrating it has the power to move and shake the Mayor of London. And we'll move on from there if we can. And if we have a look here at the C40 Cities Board of Directors, we can see that we've got Michael R. Bloomberg himself. And if we just move down to the gentleman underneath, we've got Bruce Lindsay, who's the chair of the board for the Clinton Foundation. So this very much fits with where Ben has been talking to you. It's difficult to tell where government ends and big business begins, but what we can be sure of is that very powerful players are controlling the strings of Sadiq Khan. Here's Bloomberg Philanthropies. Now, of course, on their website, they say they're doing wonderful things for the world. They've given away $17.4 billion. However, I would like to ask, where has that money come from in the first place? And secondly, what strings are attached to the money when it's given away? Because overwhelmingly, this is about transformational change in particularly poorer countries and amongst the black community. So lots of questions to be asked. If we go back to the investment, Children's Investment Fund itself, under the trustees, we see an interesting name, Masroor Siddiqui. And we've also next to him got Ben Goldsmith, who I think many people would describe as a big mover and shaker. But let's actually have a look at Siddiqui himself. And you don't have to go far to find the headline. Here's the Telegraph. And it says that he's the close confidant of Rishi Sunak, who shuns the limelight. And it points out that he's a former Goldman Sachs banking colleague of Rishi. But the key thing is, in the Telegraph article, they point out that another hedge fund, Nea Capital, started by Mr. Siddiqui, shorted or helped to short the government contractor Carillion before it imploded and went out of business in 2018 under a mere £7 billion worth of debt. So I'm going to say to our audience today, if you're worried about those ULEZ cameras, the cameras are one thing, but you've really got to understand what Sadiq Khan is doing and who is pulling him his strings to make him do what he's doing. And it's not only the cameras that have got to be brought down, it's these semi-secretive global structures which are supporting Mr. Khan. These have also got to be exposed and brought down. Ben, I wish I had more time to talk through this sort of stuff, because there are so many little alleys and tunnels that you need to get down. everything about government is becoming increasingly opaque, and we're not really sure who is governing us and what the agenda is.
That is certainly the case, Brian. I could sit here and talk about this with you all afternoon. I'm particularly interested in the young global leaders. Like, we've known about how they've penetrated the cabinets, to quote Klaus Schwab, but I'm now thinking and seeing a lot more of them in other places. And we're going to have to dig into that more over the coming weeks. Anyway, we're off to a party. We're going to the Predator's Ball with Lord Bethel of Romford. There he is, Jim Bethel in all his glory. Remember him. He's a member of the House of Lords. He's responsible for health policy. And if we just click on, we can see here, there he is, member of the House of Lords. One more click and we'll get a little bit of a briefing on him. He's responsible for health policy, and he in fact oversaw the COVID contracts and had personal ministerial responsibility for the development of the new vaccine. So he's had a terrible week and has decided to skip the country, as we'll come on to in a moment. But he's still out there, he's still issuing policy statements. So as well as being a member of the House of Lords, he's also putting out things like this, Health is Wealth, which I talked about earlier in the year, which is a joint piece of thinking with, amongst others, David Halpern from the Behavioural Insights team. And one of the things that he talks in here about is the potential of big data, database segmentation, diagnostic tools and genomics to identify, target and intervene earlier as we transition towards preventative healthcare. That's his big thing. And he's not just shaping the market as a political figure. He's also, as is often the case these days, participating in the market as a private sector individual as well. He does both at the same time. Isn't it incredible? He's a senior advisor at the Milken Institute. They had a big strategy day a couple of weeks ago to talk about preventative healthcare. And the Milken Institute relates to this fella, Michael Milken, who was known through the 70s and the 80s as the junk bond king. We click on one. Because of his role building the junk bond market. Essentially, it's a corporate Ponzi scheme. One of the most corrupt financial players of the 70s and the 80s ended up going to prison for a few years. And now he's a philanthropist, and we should all listen to what he has to say about the future of humanity. So they had a big event. It's the 27th year of the Milken Institute Global Conference, breathlessly covered all week by Politico, who now have a newsletter called The Global Playbook, by the way, which you should go and sign up to. And it does exactly what it says on the tin. Yeah, if you want to know what the globalists are up to, go and read the Global Playbook from Politico. An incredible lineup of speakers at the Milken Institute event. I mean, I'm really just scratching the surface. Bill Clinton, Javier Milei, Elon Musk, Usher, David Beckham was there. A whole bunch of different top-level business and political figures and celebrities. David Rubenstein from the Carlyle Group, one of the main beneficiaries from the war in Iraq, he was there as well. And obviously, that is exactly the type of crowd that our friend Jim Bethel likes to hang around with. So, onto a plane, like a rat up a drain pipe, off he goes. He's taken a photo here in the back of the plane. I'm going to wager that he didn't actually fly in that section. He had a much nicer section, probably lying down and all of that. But anyway, this is for the hoi polloi to look at. He did his big speech. Can you live to 100? There he is. Oh, I should have taken a better picture. I'm sorry, Jim. But yeah, he was up there talking about the future of global health, preventative healthcare, genomics, despite the fact that he has personally caused more damage to the British population's health than probably almost anyone who's ever lived in the whole of history. Anyway, he wasn't the only Muppet there. I'm going to talk through a few of the other people in attendance just to give you a sense of what was going on. So there were other Muppets. Well, Jim Bethel wasn't the only one. We had Sesame Street, the Sesame Workshop there, promoting climate resilience and health and the places where those things intersect. I also came across this, which was just wonderful. This really tells you everything you need to know about the current state of affairs. You've got someone from Amazon, Nancy Dalton, talking about building a world where convenience equity can be a reality for all. I suppose that means there aren't enough people who can get next day delivery on Amazon. So if we expand it so that everyone can, then that'll be a more just and more fair world. Anyway, back into healthcare. Let's have a little listen to Mandy Cohen from the CDC.
We've made a lot of strides, but we have more work to do. And I want to make sure that folks who are thinking about how do we keep our economy strong, how do we keep our workforce healthy, that they think about CDC and public health at large. And because if we don't invest foundationally in our health security, everything else can get shaky on top of that.
Health security, I get really nervous when people put those two words together, as just like the Health Security Agency, UK Health Security Agency. So she's the current head of the CDC. Bethel's gone to hang out with her, despite everything that we now know about what's been going on with the CDC and the COVID vaccination program. Also, we have here Mina Seshamani from Medicaid.
It is incumbent on all of us that we get the word out to all of our communities about the importance of prevention, about the importance of all of the changes happening, that we do want to care for you as a person. Mm-hmm. And here are things that you should ask your doctor, ask your nurse, so that we can make sure that the changes that we make in a 2,000-page payment regulation that sits in the Federal Register actually comes to life for people on the ground.
Ben, we really want to care for you. Sorry, Brian.
Ben, I'm watching the clock carefully, but I must come back on this. She says, get in touch, do talk to us, talk to your doctor. But when we say to the doctors, well, tell us about the safety of vaccinations, we're all told to shut up and run away and be quiet. So these people are duplicitous. They are truly disgraceful. Sorry about that.
Don't be sorry, Brian. It's not your fault. they are absolutely hideous, aren't they? Right. And this is where Bethel, who's still working around the health system in the UK, has gone to get his ideas, share his ideas. This is where he feels comfortable. One more video, Kathy Hochul. This is just an absolute clanger, but it's just when people actually say what they think out loud, it's amazing.
Young black kids growing up in the Bronx who don't even know what the word a computer is. They don't know. They don't know these things. And I want the world open up to all of them, because when you have their diverse voices innovating solutions through technology, then you're really addressing society's broader challenges.
Those stupid black people who don't know what a computer is. I mean, really, what's going on? And then finally, Anne McElvoy was there. She's an Evening Standard journalist. She was interviewing Kevin McCarthy. And we were talking earlier in the week about not letting journalists or anyone forget what they did over the past few years. Anne McElvoy, this has been on my hard drive for about 2 or 3 years now, and this is coming straight back at you. The unvaccinated have become a lethal liability that we can ill afford. I don't think that you're going to regret saying that. Anyway, over to you, Brian.
Well, over to me, but I'm going to stay quiet because otherwise I'm going to chew up more time. We'll discuss more of this in UK Column Extra. Debbie, let's bring you back on the subjects of children. I noticed in Ben's segment, it was mentioning Sesame there, and they were supposedly saying they got the best interests of children at heart. I don't think that's the case. Debbie, tell us what you've got. And I've taken a bit of your time. You take as much time as you need in this segment.
Thank you. Children, I don't really know where to start on this segment, except I'm horrified. And as all of our regular viewers and listeners will know, no one has been as quick out of the gate when it comes to child abuse, secret family courts, child protection, child trafficking than UK Column. And again, I would re-echo what Brian said in his segment. Please go to the search bar, because it's the amount of material on the website is huge. Now, we focused a lot during lockup on what was going on in elderly care homes, but actually what was going on in children's care homes and in children's social care. So I just want to start off with Ofsted's report of the main findings of children's social care in England, just to put a bit of perspective. So out of 12 million children in England, 400,000 are within the social care system. As of the 31st of March 23, 82,000 children were in care. As of 31st of March 23, there were 3,812 active or suspended social care providers in England. Just let that sink in. Now, the UK Parliament has been very busy investigating children's social care, and they've been asking, are the reforms going far enough and fast enough? Now, only last week, there was a Children's Education Committee in the House of Commons. This is one of the select committees that I really would advise everybody, please go to Parliament Live and watch these, because they really are very, very eye-opening. And in this one in particular, I'm going to show you a couple of clips. The first one is Anna Firth. Anna Firth is the MP for Southend, I believe. And I want to ask you, what do you do with vinegar? Do you pour it on your chips? Do you clean your windows with it? Have a listen to the question from Anna Firth to the head of Ofsted, Yvette Stanley.
Now bring in Anna.
Thank you, Chair. I want to now talk specifically about the Hesley Children's Homes. And we all know that in 2022, the Child Safeguarding Practice Review Panel uncovered a terrible culture of abuse and harm inside Hesley residential homes for children with complex needs. And, you know, we've read about the punching, the kicking, being fed with chilies, having vinegar poured into cuts, and over 100 reports of incidents between 2018 and 2021 in a home that was rated good by Ofsted.
Pouring vinegar into children's wounds, feeding them chilies, beating and abusing them in a home that was reported as good by Ofsted. So when Ofsted were questioned about this, and Yvette Stanley came back with her answer, of course she said they've put in lots of extra staff, they've tightened up their all of their systems, they were quite horrified. She also added this.
In COVID, no one got in. We didn't get in. So that was part of the loss of that line of sight. We must never lose a line of sight of these children if there is another pandemic. But also, what the panel alighted on was that the need for absolute clarity. When a local authority is placing a child 200 miles away and the home local authority doesn't place any children there, how do we know what's going on when, you know, 35 local authorities... And during our inspections, we would have rung up those local authorities and said, have you got any concerns? They didn't have any concerns.
They didn't have any concerns. They just got lost. Nobody bothered. And the BBC article here will give you a bit more information on what actually happened in Doncaster. And this was a culture of abuse, Fullerton House, Wilsick Hall and Wheatley House. The next slide, Stephanie, when she very kindly forwards it, will show you that Yvette Stanley in 2021 was actually in charge. She was the National Director for Regulation and Social Care. And she brought out a report, her findings. And part of the findings were that parents could only see their children for about 1.5 hours during the first lockdown. Or lock up, as I call it. So they were literally isolated. She went on to say that 80% of children's homes are owned by the private sector. Now, if we look at Ofsted's report of the main findings of the largest national providers of children's care facilities, we can see that CareTech hold the lion's share there with 10%. There's a few other companies there, Outcomes First, Compass Community. But let's look at how much was spent. And in 2020 to 2021, 11 billion was spent in children's services. I just want to take you very quickly to CareTech. Who are CareTech, since they're the largest? Well, they say they're a principal service provider delivering high quality individualized care and support within a person-centered approach. Who runs it? The gentleman that runs it is Farouk Sheikh, OBE. He started off with this single care home, but then they sold it. He did other things. And then he bought it back for £1 billion. Now, Ben might be interested to know that his CV includes Ernst Young, Coutts. He's patron and a fellow of the Prince's Trust. And he also runs a charitable foundation called COSAREF. If we go and look at COSAREF, we can actually see that one of the priority countries is the United Kingdom. And we can see the involvement there again with the Prince's Trust. So very quickly, back to the Select Committee. When this question was asked to Yvette Stanley, head of Ofsted, by Flick Drummond, who's MP for Meon Valley. She asks Yvette this question.
Just a quick one to Yvette, actually. Were you aware that people use handcuffs to transport children between different care settings or educational settings? And do you think that the use of handcuffs outside the criminal justice system is ever appropriate?
So I am aware. When I took up the national role, I became aware because we regulate the secure estate. It is a gap in regulation. I know in our submission we've produced a long list of gaps in regulation that we would like filled proportionately and carefully, etc. The Welsh Government have abolished the use outside the criminal judgment. So I absolutely understand that policy position, which will be a matter for the policymakers. I think in practice, and Michelle may and Annie may want to comment, there are better ways to support children in managing moves and helping them self-regulate. And a lot of places have done some really good work on safe handling, safe support for children in crisis. So I personally would not be advocating for it outside the criminal justice system, but Ofsted sits outside the policy decision making.
I personally would advocate for hand-holding, not handcuffing. And in this article in The Independent, you can see that the horrendous practice of handcuffing children in care must be banned, MPs warned. And in the next slide, it also says that children have been moved between care homes and court appointments with handcuffs on, and as young as 13. And just to tie up this segment, I just want to remind everybody that children in care, the councils can arrange these children to be jabbed, to be vaccinated, despite parent opposition, the High Court rules. So my question is, how many children in care have been jabbed against their will, against the consent of their parents, who didn't even know where they were?
Yeah, Debbie, thank you very much. Lots and lots of questions to be asked there about what's happening with children. But for somebody to be saying, well, of course, we lost a few, we don't know where they are, but it's not a problem, really. This tells us how disgusting UK is at the moment, not the people in principle living here, but the people who are governing the country. There's a lot we need to be bringing to the surface as quickly as possible. Ben, we're getting towards the end of the news today, but what have you got?
Yeah, so I was inspired. I'm going to risk venturing into country matters. I know Charles is much better at this than I am, but I was inspired by something he was talking about earlier in the week as it relates to a big focus on livestock and vaccination of livestock and potential pandemics circulating the food system. And we're all thinking about where the next pandemic is going to come from, or where they're going to tell us it's going to come from. But is it possible that it's going to be an attack on the food supply and not on us directly? Jeremy Farrar is the current chief scientist at the World Health Organization. He was before that the director of the Wellcome Trust. He was on SAGE, so he was responsible, not least in part, for the lockups that Debbie's been talking about and everything else that went with it. Let's just hear what he has to say about H5N1. Over the past couple of weeks.
The current outbreak, for want of a better word, in America amongst cows is really concerning as well, and also talks to this issue of transmission. We have to understand in those cow settings, sheds, how H5N1 is transmitting, because it may be evolving into transmitting in different ways. Do the milking structures of cows create aerosols? Is it the environment which they're living in? Is it the transport system that is spreading this around the country? So this is a huge concern, and I think we have to watch, more than watch, we have to make sure that if H5N1 did come across to humans with human-to-human transmission, that we were in a position to immediately respond with access equitably to vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics.
He wants to disrupt the food supply.
The other thing there is he mentioned sheds, and of course this is the harsh reality in a lot of cases in America that cows for milking are in sheds their whole life, which is not a natural environment, and then we're suddenly surprised when the cows are suffering and becoming ill.
Yeah, a lot of questions to answer. in terms of the food supply.
Indeed. All right. Thank you for that. Debbie, we're at a point where probably we should end the news. Would you like this segment to continue, or should we keep it for our UK column members in extra time?
Well, I think it deserves a bit more time, but just to tempt those of you that aren't UK column subscribers, we're going to be talking about something else that I think we need to just be keeping a very close eye on. So if you are a UK subscriber and you're able to watch extra, I think this topic really does need a little bit more discussion. So we'll hang on to it for a second, eh, Brian?
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we're out of time for UK column news today. A huge thank you to everyone who's joined us, wherever you are in the world. And I just want to say that a lot of people are now asking for the UK column to do more and more, to report this, to do more local reports, to cover this subject, to investigate this. In principle, we'd like to do all of this, but to do it, we need to increase the size of our team. And if we are to do this, we need more support from our audience in the form of memberships. And I'll just say once again that for £5 a month, we think our audience receives a huge amount of information, a great deal of reporting, videos, the interviews, etc. So if you're listening to us wherever you are in the world and you're not a paid member, please consider doing that, because this would allow us to expand and to deliver more for everybody. I'm just going to end with a unique thing. I think it's called an unboxing, if I remember what the youngsters get up to on YouTube. So I have here a little box. It's got a very nice little tin box inside. And inside the tin box is a really exceptionally beautiful, where are we, if you can see that. That is a lighter of the Zippo style. I'll just click it open, but truly lovely. It's engraved with UK column. We think it would make a beautiful gift and also a lighter for you to use on many occasions, whether it's cigarettes or candles or incense sticks or the campfire or the home fire. Many different uses for a responsible lighter. And if you fancy one of these, they will be available shortly in the UK column shop. So I'll leave you to think about that, but the minimum is you need one of these lighters to light a candle at home so that you can relax a little bit from all this madness in a comfy chair and enjoy the subtle light of that flickering candle. I'll leave you to think about that. Very big thank you to Debbie and to Ben for joining me today. We will be back on Monday at the same time. If you're a UK column member, stay with us. In a few minutes, we'll have UK column extra and we'll be delving into those exciting subjects. We will see you then. Bye-bye.